Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Colorado Gardener, read by Christy McGowan, featuring articles from Better Homes and Gardens and Green Prints. From Garden to Cup. Cultivate a tea garden for pretty blooms and a relaxing ritual. Host a Bridgerton-worthy tea party featuring cups you brewed with leaves straight from your own garden. By Sophia Beams. And this is from BetterHomesAndGardens.com. There's nothing that screams spring like gardening and a traditional tea party. So why not combine them? It has been a long-standing trend that's been brewing, and it's especially popular among home gardeners this year, thanks to the newest season of Bridgerton. If you've never heard of a tea garden before, it's exactly what it sounds like. A garden composed of plants that can be made into a perfect cup of tea. You might be growing one or two varieties already, but if you are a dedicated tea lover, consider getting creative and giving yourself more options. First, you need to know your planting zone in order to determine what types of tea you can grow. If you're worried about your tea plants thriving in a harsh climate, there are also a few varieties you can grow indoors. You'll also want to figure out your favorite kinds of tea and which kinds go together. Maybe you're a fan of winding down with a cup right before bed and want to brew up your own creation to help you relax. In that case, chamomile would help you out. It grows in plenty of zones, and you can use both the leaves and the flowers in moderation. Tea plants usually come with plenty of blooms to make your garden look as good as it tastes. Camellia, commonly referred to as tea plant, can be grown in four zones, or indoors, and has a luscious pink color. Keep in mind, you have to opt for Camellia sinensis if you want a traditional cup of tea. This plant creates white, green, oolong, and black teas, but there are several other varieties that give a different flavor. When you're choosing your tea plants, think about the concoctions you'll be making. The goal isn't just to make a single tea from each plant you grow. You can mix and match leaves and buds from the plants in your garden to create a more complex, layered drink. Butterfly pea flowers make a tea mocktail more visually interesting with its intense blue or purple color, while lemon balm leaves offer a relaxing effect for your nighttime sip. Jasmine, lemon balm or lemon verbena, mint, lavender, eucalyptus, and lemongrass can all easily be grown and harvested for tea later on. Note that if you're planning on growing mint, it's known for taking over backyards. Indoor or outdoor pots help to keep it contained. With camellias, use the buds of flowers to brew white tea. Younger leaves make lighter teas, resulting in a nice green tea. The bigger the leaf, the darker the tea. The oldest leaves on your plant get you black or oolong teas. If you're hoping for a flowery tea, try growing Roselle. It also makes the prettiest addition to any garden. Fallen apples, Fruits and Failings of the Season by Diana Wells. And this is from Green Prints, October 2024 edition. My brother's birthday is in the autumn. He celebrates it with first visits to the beach, anticipation of summer, delight in spring. The children, he tells me, are looking forward to the long hot holidays and their traditional Christmas barbecue. My brother lives down under, in Australia. I used to wonder how he could bear it. The bath water running away in the wrong direction, the sun crossing the northern sky. Spring, when it should be autumn. We both grew up in Britain, where as children we thought Australia was the bottom of the world. But at least I didn't have to change hemispheres when I came to Pennsylvania. Gardening, however, is beginning to teach me that it doesn't really matter that much. We are always in several seasons at once. You ought to know that October is the first spring month, says Carol Capick in The Gardener's Year. It may seem that all is dying, but underground, new roots are being formed, and above ground, buds, all getting ready for the showy side of gardening in spring. For winter is sleep, not death, as all gardeners know. Poets may be thinking of death and prudent homeowners of double glazing and central heating, but gardeners, idealistic and romantic as ever, are planting drifts of chionodoxia, or trotting foolishly around with clumps of divided perennials, trying to find a gap somewhere to put them. We do not throw them out and get on with planning the oil payments, for our minds are on spring. Indeed, instead of putting aside fuel money, we behave as though winter never existed. We keep running out and buying just a few more bulbs for that dull corner we had forgotten when we sent out our bulb order in June. There is no excuse. Sometimes we are lucky enough to be married to someone who will chop wood or think about the oil bill. Fall, of course, is not only a season, but a state of humanity, and gardeners, from the very first, have never been able to resist temptation. It was surely in autumn, the time of ripening fruits, that Eve successfully got Adam to take a bite. We read nowadays that men's hormonal levels are highest in autumn, thus increasing their libido at that season. It all fits in very well with that seductive scene in the first garden. Tradition has it that the fruit was an apple, although some scholars root for pomegranates, figs, apricots, or oranges. As a so-called organic gardener, I feel it must have been an apple, because apples are where, for me, temptation and the non-resistance of it meet. The most perfect apple in literature, that offered to Snow White, was poisoned. So perfect was it that she simply could not resist, though she really knew better. The merchant in Beauty and the Beast had similar problems, an irresistible rose in a snowy winter garden. Nature disapproves of such things, and as an organic gardener, I believe in nature. My creed goes something like this. I believe absolutely in organic gardening. I believe that poisons are ruining the environment. I believe in mulch. I believe in milky spore. I believe in companion planting. I believe in compost. I know, O Lord, that healthy plants resist insects. I believe in the spirit of Bacillus thuringiensis. I have done things I ought not to have done, and I have not done things I ought to have done. But I truly believe in the protection of safer soap, and I trust in the spirit of nature. Blessed is the man, or woman, however, who can see the perfection of the rose, ravaged by beetles, and not run weeping to the nearest garden center for poisonous spray. Even more blessed is he or she who can grow apples organically. I planted a dozen dear little apple trees, thinking I wouldn't mind sharing a part of some of them with the odd worm. But it was not a matter of sharing with nature. Nature wanted them all. Now, I didn't do sticky traps and painted balls and non-poisonous sprays because I simply decided I would share. What happened was that I didn't get a single apple, even the year that I sold my soul to the devil. I didn't even do that properly, but applied sprays sporadically, at half strength. Thus, everyone was happy. The manufacturers of the sprays, the worms, the devil, and the merchants who sold me the sprayed apples, which I eventually had to buy. Only the environment and myself lost out. From the point of view of the modern capitalist economy, the experiment was a great success. But you see what I mean about apples. My grandfather grew apples and loved his orchard with a passion. He was a doctor and tenderly bound his grafts onto the branches with yards of pink surgical tape. In those days of post-war Britain, we did not get many sweets, and I eagerly accepted the windfalls I was allowed to eat when we visited. I do not remember ever actually eating a whole apple. We were expected to cut out the bad parts, for the perfect apples were stored on slotted shelves in the cellar, and one only got to eat those during the winter, when they were shriveled and wrinkled, but very sweet. Grandfather did get some good apples, but there were a lot of rotted windfalls too, which attracted yellow jacket wasps. Like Gilbert White, 200 years before him, grandfather made traps from jars or bottles with a small entrance hole, luring the wasps in with a little irresistible jam or beer at the bottom. I used to watch them buzz furiously in the jar, hitting the edges of the exit hole again and again, and wonder that they could not just be still a minute, and realize that by crawling up the sides of the jar and across to the little hole, they could easily get out the way they had come in. They did not learn, but buzzed themselves to a fury until they finally lay feebly struggling in the liquid at the bottom, surrounded by the rotting bodies of the no less foolish predecessors. In autumn, we too go a little more slowly. In spite of everything, as Alan Lacey says in his excellent book, The Autumn Garden, the season is imprisoned in a system of easy but misleading metaphors. In other words, it is generally equated with the cycle, and therefore the exiting years of human life. In September, says Vita Sackville-West, we approach 70, and then comes October, and November, and December, when it would be tactless to pursue the analogy any further. Perhaps, though, that's not all bad, even if we accept the analogy. Youth, like spring, can be giddy and exhausting, at least from the point of view of autumn. My mother remarried at the age of 50, and I remember wondering why, at that time of life, she bothered. Wouldn't she be just as happy, thought I, aged 20, settling down with a book in the intervals between visits when we felt like coming home? Autumn is reassuring in that way. Rather than settling down, there is a quieter, though often brilliant, continuation of what has gone on before. Alan Lacey tells us he counted 75 flowers in bloom in his September garden, but only 39 in the same garden in April. "I tell you," says Carol Capek, "that this flowering of mature age is more vigorous and passionate than those restless and passing tossings of the young spring." So I, too, in my adopted land of young grandmothers, am not giving up, and I seem to reach for the scarlet autumn skirt rather than the ubiquitous black worn by so many women of my age in older and perhaps more realistic cultures. But even if I am a grandmother, the obvious lesson of decay and death, per Dudley Warner, is not necessarily the lesson of autumn. For autumn is the season of seed setting, the time when nature is thinking of future generations. Alan Lacey's 75 flowers, like my autumn red skirt, are all very well. But the purpose of the whole thing was not flowers for our enjoyment, but seeds for posterity. I may be a remontant grandmother, and I am thoroughly enjoying my blaze before inevitable, if not imminent, senescence. I may understand now why my mother could marry at my age. But it's my grandson, baby Simon, the apple of my eye, who's going into the future. Without our children and without the seeds of autumn, there is no future. Perhaps we should look at the way nature puts everything into those seeds when we are told there's not enough money for education, childcare, medicine for the young. Nature doesn't take risks like that. Those soft petals, alluring fragrances, dusky pollens, erect stamens, heady colors, and mad spring tangles were all for those funny little brown seeds we are seeing everywhere. Autumn flowers are pretty reminders, but now it's too late for them to set seed. A truly successful autumn garden is full of seeds. Seeds and wisps and tassels and buried clusters of buds left above the brilliant leaf carpet and of roots digging down, as children do, towards Australia. How to grow and care for a banana plant indoors. These essential tips will help you successfully grow bananas as a houseplant, by Savannah Boos. And this is from betterhomesandgardens.com. Growing a banana plant indoors probably isn't the first thing that comes to mind when considering adding greenery to your home. Elephant ears, monsteras, or snake plants might already have a spot in your house and heart, but there's always room for more. Banana plants add a tropical feeling to any room with their huge, shiny leaves. However, don't expect a bunch of bananas to decorate your living room. When grown inside, banana plants hardly ever produce fruit. So get a big planter and make some room, because a banana will be your new favorite addition to your houseplant collection. Best banana varieties to grow indoors. You're probably most familiar with the Cavendish variety, which is the type of banana sold in supermarkets across America. Its classic yellow fruit is heart healthy and what we use as a smoothie mix in. However, not all bananas have yellow skin. Blue Java bananas have a turquoise peel, while red bananas have a deep burgundy-colored peel. In the wild, a banana tree can easily reach 20 to 40 feet high. Their red or purple flowers eventually produce the bunches of bananas we're used to seeing in the grocery stores. When growing a banana plant indoors, be conscious of the space you have. Because they can grow so tall, the classic Cavendish isn't a good choice. Instead, look for dwarf varieties of banana plants. These will be the best choice for growing as a houseplant. If you're thinking of growing a banana plant indoors from a store-bought fruit, note that these bananas have been bred to be seedless. Otherwise, bananas would be practically inedible because of the large hard seeds that grow in the fruit. How to grow a banana plant indoors. Potting. Give your banana a pot that is about twice the size of the root system of the plant. Make sure your container has drainage holes. Fill the container with fresh potting mix. Don't cover the leafy layers of the stalk with soil. Light. Indigenous to tropical areas near the equator, banana plants need lots of sun. Outside, bananas grow in full sun. So indoors, you want to give them as much light as you can, whether that's natural light, artificial light, or a mix of both. You want your plant to be able to cast the strong shadow most of the day. Purchasing a growing lamp will help keep your banana plant healthy throughout the winter. Banana plants do best with at least 6 hours of direct sunlight, meaning they will need to be placed close to a south or west-facing window. Temperature and humidity. Banana plants like it warm and wet. They can grow in zones 9 through 11 in the United States. Banana plants indoors should be kept between 67 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit. They'll stop growing in colder temperatures. With more water, banana plants can handle higher temperatures, but they prefer not to. Water. Water your banana plant indoors frequently enough to keep the soil constantly moist but not soggy. If allowed to sit in water, this plant could get root rot. Fertilizer. Banana houseplants are frequent feeders. Give yours a healthy and frequent dose of fertilizer. Aim to give your banana plant fertilizer once a month. Spread an even amount of balanced soluble fertilizer throughout the pot for best results. Pests and problems. The most common problem with banana plants indoors is root rot from overwatering. Make sure you never let your plant sit in water. Watch out for spider mites. These tiny, nearly transparent pests usually hide out on the underside of leaves. Dust, dirt, and debris will settle on your banana plant's leaves over time. A quick wipe down will help keep the plant healthy and looking its best. Run a clean, soft cloth over your plant's leaves about once a month. In addition to banana plants, there are other tropical plants and fruits to grow indoors. Grow flowering tropical plants for colorful blooms, or for more simple greenery, ferns make great indoor plants. Thank you for joining us for Colorado Gardener. My name is Christy McGowan.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.